on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
A lot of people say animism is the belief that all things have a soul. And what I would say to that is, it is not a belief, it is the experience that everything has a soul or has consciousness. And within that awareness is everything in relationship. Everything is connected. And that means that we're deeply responsible for each other. Everything has agency. And that means that we have impact on everything around us. And we're being impacted by everything around us. And so animism is a lot of different things. There's not one way to animism. And it is what our ancestors way, way back would have explored as their spiritual experience. And it is what we all are when we come into this world now. We have a tendency to look at animism as this archaic, uncivilized expression of religion from our deep past, but it is also part of who we are when we first come here.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by Death Walker, Death Doula, animist, and author Kelly Harrell to discuss her book, From Elder to Ancestor, Nature Kinship for All Seasons of Life. Kelly discusses the broken path we currently walk, the importance of responsible elderhood, cultivating a grounded, embodied spiritual practice, and how to heal intergenerational and environmental traumas. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Kelly Harrell is an animist, death walker, and death doula. Through her nature-based soul-tending practice, Soul Intent Arts, she helps others ethically build thriving spiritual paths through rune work, animism, ancestral tending, and death work. She's the author of several books, including Runic Book of Days. She joins me today to discuss her latest publication, From Elder to Ancestor, Nature Kinship for All Seasons of Life. Kelly, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Nick.
Yes. Well, I'm very happy that you're here with me. I think that we have a lot of shared interests, and I think that we come at them from slightly different perspectives at times, but I think there is a lot of commonality in the way we approach these things. I thought that maybe the place to begin is with animism, because that is something that is crucial and central to this text, to your work. And not everyone is familiar with what animism is. So I thought that that would be my first question. What is animism?
Okay. A lot of people say animism is the belief that all things have a soul. And what I would say to that is, it is not a belief, it is the experience that everything has a soul or has consciousness. And within that awareness is everything in relationship. Everything is connected. And that means that we're deeply responsible for each other. Everything has agency. And that means that we have impact on everything around us. And we're being impacted by everything around us. And so animism is a lot of different things. There's not one way to animism. And it is what our ancestors way, way back would have explored as their spiritual experience. And it is what we all are when we come into this world now. We have a tendency to look at animism as this archaic, uncivilized expression of religion from our deep past, but it is also part of who we are when we first come here. We all come out aware that trees are alive and we talk to them, and we have invisible friends that we play with, and we set place settings at the table for our invisible friends and stuffed animals. And then sometime around adolescence, we get challenged with this need to give that up because that's babyish. It somehow interferes with our development into how the world really wants us to be. So there are some challenging thoughts behind an animistic perspective, which for me are responsibility and how I move in this world matters in ways way bigger than I know.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. My understanding is, my short answer is always that everything is ensouled. And it's an ensouled universe. The universe has a soul. The earth has a soul. Everything has soul to it.
I love that.
Yeah. I think that I want to step back just for a moment, because there is a larger context for what you're doing in this book. And one is that I think, and I think it's fair, and I think that you agree with this in the book, is that we're all kind of traumatized, that we began, you know, historically, you know, as you mentioned, there was, our ancestors had this animistic worldview, but yet that got broken, that got overturned. And I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that's what you mean when you write about the broken path. And so I thought that maybe we can spend a few moments talking about what got us onto this, you know, how did our path become broken? How did we get to this point from everything is ensouled to trees are just dead matter?
Yeah. I think for me, it's important to frame that with what my positionality is, which is as a white female American, like different intersectionalities of my own, but that's the big thing. And there are some people who would say that it isn't broken and they have had lived animistic tradition that is unbroken and in different parts of the world, not just here. But from my vantage point and the experience that I've had in my ancestry, it is broken. And in the culture that I have to interface with every day, all the time, it is broken from an animistic worldview. That is, we are not just part of nature, we are nature. And in that previous conversation about, you know, animism is an awareness of ensoulment, that nature is part of that. We're not just talking about other humans. We're not just talking about other human persons, but all persons, all spirit persons. So my understanding is many factors came into play with why we became either a broken path or perhaps less able to express our animism. Part of it is climate change. Part of it is, you know, literally being cut off from lands that we would have frequented for thousands of years by climate change. And then the ensuing human imposed systems on how we're going to manage life. Now that that significant change has happened, we would become larger groups that don't move around quite as much. And that would require some semblance of governance and setting of boundaries that might have clashed with the way that we lived before, that would have clashed with our animism. And then from those symptoms, and this is like radically oversimplifying, we would have had rulership and power hunger that we didn't have before. We would have had illnesses that we didn't have before because we're in these tighter, larger communities. And I mean, to really put a pin in it, we had religious institutions rise that saw value in our ancestral land resources that took them over, and that broke us from traditional lands where we would have been in animistic relationship for thousands of years unbroken. And if we've had anything animistic that we've learned in the last, I would say even 5 years, is when you can break people from their relationship to their land, you can inflict a trauma that rolls out for generations. And that comes with so many tangential traumas. And when we look far enough back, those are the layerings of things that happened that broke us from animistic tradition.
Yes, thank you for that. One of the ways that I look at things is that it's a variation on the old Hermetic principle of as above, so below, but it's as within, so without. And I see what's happening now in terms of our environment, and that's not just climate change, but the possible mass extinction and various other things, that is representative of something within the human soul. And it's a deep, deep wound. It's a deep intergenerational wound, I think. And it seems to me that it's a spiritual wound, and that's what needs to be healed.
Absolutely. And I think there's a challenge in saying in the positionality that I have, I'm an animist because I like having electricity. I like having air conditioning, particularly now in this time when we're experiencing heat like we've never experienced it before. There's challenge in that at a deep personal level of saying, what does that mean to me to be animistic and live that in the ways that I can, and at the same time realize what actual limitations there are to survive in this system. And for me, it looks very different for people who are marginalized in other ways.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. And what's kind of at the heart of this, I think, and it's what you were speaking about, is this colonial culture. I think you refer to it a lot as the settler culture. And a couple of things come to mind, because the other aspect here, and kind of where I want to get to, is as well, you discuss lore. And from my background, there are a couple of works that inform all of this. One is the work of Thomas Berry, who says that we need a new story, that the stories that we're telling of our cosmologies are what's contributing. And if I understand your use of lore correctly, you're kind of saying the same thing. It's that the stories that we're telling are perpetuating this, and we need to tell new stories. Am I on the right track with that?
Absolutely. And to turn the screw ever so slightly more, if we're willing to question our lores, then we have to also question our cosmologies. And that hits in a way that people don't like. Like, as long as we keep it at this story level and it's kind of got some distance from me, and it might be even in the past or not here yet, so I don't have to worry about it. That's one thing. But when we start talking about maybe there are parts of your cosmology that are unhealthy, that you don't realize are creating harm, or maybe you're paying into some things through your cosmology that don't feed other people. They may serve you, but they don't feed other people who need to be fed. That's where the question of what is your lore and how are you living it? What are you contributing to it that makes it catch the descendants in a way that they're going to have their needs met? That's when it becomes a whole different discussion.
Definitely cosmology is a huge part of this, because the other work that has been influential for me is this. It's a pretty old article now. I think it's about 56, 57 years old. The Roots of Our Environmental Crises by UCLA historian Len White Jr. And what they did is they suggested that it was the story of Genesis, which, we have in the West, industrialized world. It is the Abrahamic traditions informed our cosmology. And at one point, he noted that the greatest psychic wounding to humanity was the eradication of, the term he used was paganism, but I think it would be fair to say animism.
I'm with you on that. Yeah. What does that fall really mean? What does cast out of the garden say? Because to me, that means you're not nature. And so are we saying animism?
I don't know, but I think that the you know, the cosmology has to change, but it's difficult. You know, it's a story. We have to tell new stories. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you, since we're talking about cosmology, and again, this is the philosophy professor in me. I always want to be clear on our terminologies. For anyone's like, well, what's a cosmology? Yeah, it seems to me, I would normally define it as like a story of our origins and our place in creation.
I love that.
Yeah.
And it can include whatever it needs to include. It can be science. It can be fictional. It can be spiritual, metaphoric.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the cosmology that you present in the book, because I think you do offer a cosmology, and animism is central to that. What else would you add, or what's missing in our description of the cosmology that you're presenting?
I feel like that's challenging to answer, because part of what we have been wired to do in the stories that we've been given thus far is to just believe what we're told.
Right.
This is it. So just pick it up and go with it. And I cannot do that. I cannot do that in what I teach or the way that I move. And what I encourage people to do is explore who is in your cosmology, ask a lot of questions, be willing to hold it flexibly, playfully, curiously, and remember that if we're rolling with animism, that means that it is all alive in a way that you can interact with it. You can ask questions. You can be curious about that relationship directly with aspects of your cosmology.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that often people experience these ideas of a new cosmology as almost an attack on self.
Sure. Sure. And that is part of it also. It's like we don't necessarily have a sense of what self is. And that exploration of who's in there, because who's in there is, at least in my vernacular, without filters in how they are in relationship with what's out here. Mm-hmm. Like it for myself at a mindful level, that's all well and good, but we have shadow, we have inner parts of us that are maybe not quite operating on the same information that our present mindful aspect is, and they are still. The metaphor that I use all the time when I'm teaching is they're in the car. They may not be in the front seat, but they are in the car and they're telling you that, you know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? They're poking you. And so the more familiar you are with your internal cosmology, the more likely you're going to have a better relationship with cosmology and how you move among in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that inner cosmology. Can you say a little bit more about that?
I feel like this is the conversation that people have when we say mind, body, soul, but that has gotten, it's gotten kind of nerfed in a way that we just accept that, oh, mind, body, soul. Yes, of course. But what is that? What does that mean? And is it the same for everybody? Maybe parts of it are not, but we don't know that until we venture in and explore. And in the work that I do from a soul tending standpoint, we're all dealing with shadow. We're all dealing with aspects of soul loss to some degree. And we're also dealing with possessions, however micro or macro they may be. We're deciding what we're weaving among in media and influences all the time that generate feelings that sometimes stick and get exacerbated in ways that we're like, where did that come from? Yeah. There are internal aspects of us in relationship that we need to be familiar with as well within those breakdowns of mind, body, soul. And from my experience, the one among those that is most immediate is body, and it's the one that gets the least amount of attention. Right. It's the one that tells us the truth immediately every time.
Yeah. Yeah, I always find it interesting. And this is something that I've had to, it's a journey that I've taken personally, is recognizing the importance of being an embodied being, because our culture encourages us in many ways to focus on mind as something that is separate from body.
Yes, yes. And I would also say to hold spirituality above without realizing it's all spiritual. It is all in relationship. There is no hierarchy. It is all about embodiedness. And that's a buzzword that I feel like, at least from in Instagram land, carries a little bit of judgment. Like, if you're embodied, that means everything is fine. That means you're manifesting everything and your resources are where they need to be and you're doing great, your mental health is fine. And embodiment means being here.
Right.
Being as here as you can be at any given time. And for myself and for a lot of people, sometimes being here does not feel good. If you're disabled, if you have chronic illness, it can be really challenging to be embodied and still feel like you're in quality relationship with aspects of yourself and the world.
Yeah, I don't spend a lot of time watching spiritual videos on TikTok or the shorts, but I understand what you're talking about. But what I see often, longer form videos, is spirituality being almost synonymous now with the ability to manifest.
Yes, productivity.
Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know that that's what spirituality ought to be. And something that you wrote, I think, and this is connected to what you had just said. I think that what is missing in these notions of embodiment, one, that it's focused on individual body, and animism is a challenge to these notions of individualism.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And I think that what is also missing is this idea of the connection with place. And this is what I love that you wrote, that we are place made flesh.
We forget that, yeah. or had it taken from us. But absolutely. One of the things that resonated with me years ago studying with Sandra Ingerman was her perspective that we really don't attain or achieve anything that isn't coming through our ecosystem. Like, where you stand, that is your key relationship that grounds you, keeps you in touch with health, with resources, everything that's needed. And that was the spark of ending up for me at, okay, we are place.
Yeah. I think we are. and I think it's to our detriment that we ignore that. And I think there has to be some kind of intention to develop a relationship with place.
Agreed. Where I live, that is challenging. Maybe for anyone here, but I know what my version of that challenge is at this time. And it includes land that witnessed really terrible things and between humans. And so even when it has a human having this conversation and making these offerings and overtures in relationship, at first, the longer standing aspects of the ecosystem where I live now were kind of like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
And we don't talk about that. Yeah. We don't talk about when you place yourself on land without having those conversations with the ecosystem. What do you do when it says no, thank you? And that is your path.
Right. Yeah. I personally I've talked about this before on my podcast. I lived in Pasadena in California for a while, and I liked that I was close to the mountains, and there was a hiking trail that ran through a small canyon, and I hiked that same trail every week for like 11 years because I intentionally wanted to get to know a place.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Yeah.
That's what it takes. Mm-hmm. And I think often when we talk about what kind of ritual we need to have, that kind, the kind that you are already doing, the kind that you can work in and say, I'm going to do this once a week. That's what our ecosystem's looking for. It doesn't have to be this grand, sexy, detailed ritual as we think of them.
Yeah. And I now have a challenge because I moved back to Denver and I love Colorado. It's amazing. But Denver's far away from the mountains. You know, I used to be able to ride my bicycle. It took me a 40-minute bike ride to get to my trail. But now it's like a 40, 45-minute car ride just to get to a trail. And so that's a question. How do those of us who are listeners who live in cities and live in urban areas, how do we make a connection to place?
I think it's challenging when you just have more. You have more relationship to have to kind of sift through. But I always encourage people to do really simple things, like to have this tree that you speak to every time as you come and go, and, you know, leave a tiny offering, and also make note of seasonality. I feel like season is hugely important. Even now, when climate change is altering our experience of season, to notice how your home, like literally your structure, what side of the house, of my apartment, is the sun rising on? How is it different? How does it feel different? What's growing now? And we're like, I know the answers to that. It's not the same as being in relationship with seasonality in that way and giving it your express attention. Like, we know what grows and what dies and when, but it's different when you're giving it your attention on a regular basis. And when you can find those tiny rituals to do on a daily basis, within a week, you will start feeling responses to them.
Yeah, a couple of things to say in regards to all of that. One, I agree with you that looking at being mindful of the seasons and seasonal changes is important. And I've always marked like the solstices and the equinoxes, and because there's a rhythm to it all. And I learned how disconnected we are. And I will give you two examples. One is I was in a class, I was teaching a class, and it was on the summer solstice. And I mentioned, you know, happy solstice, everyone. And one of the students is like, well, what's the summer solstice? And I said, well, it's the longest day of the year. And their response was, well, what do you mean? There's like 25 or 26 hours. And I'm like, no. But then, you know, and that was a student. And but last week I was in a meeting with other PhDs, and it was on the midsummer. And I had mentioned, because someone was talking about that, and I mentioned, oh, yes. And today, in fact, is midsummer. And they were like, no. That was back in June. I'm like, no. That was the beginning of summer. That's not the midsummer. And just basically getting us in alignment again with those seasonal changes seems so important, but it's such a challenge from student to PhD.
It is. That's what my previous book was on, working with the runes in a seasonal calendric timing. And I think it's hugely important. I think my memo for people on that is stand. Just go out, go stand. If you can't stand outside, pick a window that you're going to sit by same-ish time every day. Crack it. What do you smell? What do you see? What do you hear? Really be there. And even though we have those planetary markers, how we experience that seasonality is changing. That's one of the things that I'm going to be teaching coming up, is like, how does that affect our rituals? Summer is not the summer that I grew up with here anymore. So am I, when I do a ritual, which one am I calling on? Or both? And how does that factor into how I hold space, how here I am? I think it matters.
No, I agree. I definitely think it matters. And also to add to kind of what we've been talking about here, when I specifically when I was asking, you know, how do people in like urban areas do this connection? You're like, find a tree. It seems that it would also be important to kind of recognize that we're always in nature. Even if you're in the middle of Manhattan or something, you're still in nature.
Even when you're indoors.
Yeah. Yeah.
That freaks people out, though, because they want indoors to be a distinction from nature.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But we're always in nature. Yeah. And also, we are nature.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. So I want to ask about, because we haven't actually talked about the title at all of the book, and this idea of an elder. And so I was wondering if you could maybe speak to that a little bit, and maybe that journey from elder to ancestor.
We have in American culture, at least, this perspective that you reach a certain age and you're either declared an elder or you just assume you're an elder. And my experience, particularly as an animist, is there's an enormous gap there. There's an enormous gap in the leadership and the wisdom that has gone before me that has not addressed that we are nature. And so also, there are, I would say over the last 5 years in particular, much conversation around ancestor work in the spiritual community, which is fabulous. It's so needed. And for even longer, conversation around intergenerational trauma. And so I'm like, where am I in that gap? Where am I? And what is my job? Like, I'm Gen X. Like, what is my job? What is my role to get the things done here that I'm here to do, to foster other people to get the stuff done that they're here to do and die well and be a good ancestor? And what I came back with was that is a lifelong practice. We don't just roll up at it and I'm an elder now, I'm ready to go. It takes a lifelong practice in relationship as nature, with nature, to really know what that is for each of us. It's not the same for each of us. And that's what I wanted to explore in the book, particularly through the lens of animism and through the soul technology that I know and use that helps us get there.
Yeah, I was trying to find the quote here, and I don't know if I can find it, but I think I can kind of summarize it, that at one point you noted that we kind of have to become our own elders because there seems to be a lack of elders.
There's so much conversation around that in the pagan community. There was an article going around last week about Gen Z and slightly younger turning to the internet for instruction instead of turning to elders. And the focus of the article was pointing out all these pagan elders who are aging and not supported by a community and who have died. And this whole generation isn't going to know who they are. And I read it and I kind of sat with it and I was like, okay. So much of what we had in my age range, the late 80s, early 90s in pagan culture isn't something I would want to bring forward. There was a rampant amount of power abuse, sexual assault, and bad intel that I wouldn't want to bring forward. And so I'm curious in the conversations around elderhood, what it means for people individually. What do you want in an elder? What does it mean to be an animistic elder? How are you going to know when you get there? Because I don't think anybody else can tell you. And then we live among traditions that are indigenous, that have very clear markers for what it means to be an elder, and it is something that is bestowed by a community. And how do we find balance in relationship with that?
Yeah. I appreciate that, because I think there's often this idea that you just hit a certain age and you automatically become an elder. And I don't think that's true, because elderhood seems to imply a certain amount of wisdom.
I'm with you.
Yeah. And just because you hit a certain age does not mean that you are wise.
We've had that. We're living under that leadership, and it has not worked yet.
Right. So how does, I mean, your whole book kind of addresses this, but how do we become an elder? I think at one point you another term that you use a lot is humaning. And it seems like that when we recognize this humaning and engage in that practice, that's kind of the path towards elderhood. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I think so. And, you know, the take that I went down in the book is, if we are humaning well, and that means we're owning our stuff, and we are exercising all our skills at the best of our ability, which changes at given times, we become this person who is aware and holding space for other people to do the same. It's not just about humaning ourselves. It's realizing that as we human ourselves well, that we're creating a space where other people are welcome to do the same. And we can sit with that, and we can hold that. And I do feel like that imparts wisdom. It imparts respect for our own knowledge and the knowledge in the communities around us. That is being a good elder.
Yeah. I want to stay here for a moment, because I think some people may listen to this and say, well, what do you mean humaning? You know, I'm already human. I was born human.
For me, I look at that as we are the custodians of the planet. We are the ones that, in the current arrangement of science and physics, have the thumbs, and we have the capacity to evoke change and manifestation in a way that maybe mountain cannot, maybe grass cannot, or other beings that we move among all the time. We have that to our advantage. And for me, humaning well means getting behind that in a way that blesses us all. Getting behind that agency in a way that blesses us all. We talk about adulting all the time. And while I get that, I'm Gen X, I get it.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's just part of it. It's part of it. It's not extra. It's part of humaning and integrating that, the places where it is prickly and it isn't always comfortable. And I'm going to hold space for myself to do the best that I can with that. I'm going to hold space for other people to do the best they can with it.
Yeah. I'm Gen X as well. So Gen X solidarity. Well, and it's interesting, because our generation has been, we're a forgotten generation in many ways, you know, and I'm hoping to see a step up a little bit. I think there's a part of being Gen X. It's like, yeah, no, we're okay. We're used to just being ignored a little bit, but I think it's our time.
I think you're right. Yeah. I see so many people say, you know, well, millennials are the ones demonstrating. They're the ones that, you know, really started rolling. And I'm like,
yeah
I see that. And hello.
Right.
I mean, depression of an entire generation, which is the other word for apathy,
right,
is its own demonstration, and we have to elder through that somehow.
Yeah. I hope that we can. I hope that we can. But still staying with this idea of humaning, a question, a way I think about this too, is my background, my education, I am an environmental virtue ethicist. And, you know, it's these character traits. You want to identify these character traits, and that are beneficial and that lead to flourishing, that lead to human flourishing.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, sure. It's well, what I'm thinking of here is there's a philosopher. She passed away several years ago, Philippa Foot, and she was trying to base and this comes out of her book, I think it's called Natural Virtues, where she's trying to place the virtues, the beneficial character traits, at the species level. And the example that she gives is of a wolf. And she says that a virtuous wolf is one that participates in the hunt, whereas a vicious wolf, and she doesn't mean vicious in terms of like grrr, but, you know, one of vice, is one that participates in the feast, but not the hunt. And it seems to me that when we look at this question of humaning and becoming a human, we also need to kind of ask the question of, well, what makes a good human?
I feel like we're waking up. I still feel like a lot of us realize, especially coming through COVID, how stacked the systems are against us. Even people who pre-COVID were like, it's good, everything's fine. Yeah. They get it now. But what's the next step that activates that to out-create the vicious tendency?
Yeah. Yeah, because our vices are what is in large part creating this environmental nightmare that we're entering.
It seems. And apathy is part of that.
Yeah. So apathy is a vice. I guess what would be the antidote to that would be compassion.
And maybe personal power. Again, not meaning as an individual, our power is discrete, but remembering that we have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a theme that comes up a lot in the conversations that I have on the podcast, is that we need to remember who we are.
Yes.
Yeah. And it seems that, you know, that's a trick. That's tricky. How do you remember who you are or were? Because it seems in many ways we're a species with amnesia.
I think we have to ask why the amnesia, because the systems that we live among not only don't foster our awareness of who we are, but they actively are in opposition to us remembering it. A lot of people can get to, well, the system doesn't give me time to remember who I am, but they're not getting to, and the system is keeping you from having the time.
Yeah.
There's two things happening there, and that's the grassroots part of changing the system, I think.
Right. Yeah, the other thing that kind of comes to mind is to go back to ideas of embodiment, because you said that you worked with Sandra Ingerman, and I know in some of the shamanic cultures, the shamanic initiation, the shaman experiences this sort of symbolic dismemberment. And the initiatory practice, the initiation, is to literally remember the body. And it seems that that then is kind of crucial here, to go back to this embodiment. Because at one point you wrote, and I love this line, the body keeps the lore. That the body is, if I understand that correctly, it's all these stories are within us, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate the work around the scorekeeping. There's more to it than that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The body doesn't have a choice but to know the lore and hold it and keep acting out of it until we continue the story, change the narrative.
Yeah, and that's the cultural narrative, but we also have personal narratives, right? Yeah. That is also kept within the body.
Definitely.
Yeah. So along these lines, towards the end of your book, you discuss grounding. There's embodiment and grounding. And I was wondering if you could maybe discuss the difference, because I believe you noted that people seem to use those terms as being synonymous, but you're like, no, they're not.
Yeah, and that's kind of an awareness I've lived into through another friend, Langston, who I also reference in the book a couple of times. This understanding that, you know, we say things like, well, touching a tree helps me ground, or having being barefoot in the grass helps me ground, which is all well and good, but that's still a relationship that's happening. And being able to be present to the relationship that the tree is having, and whether it wants to help you ground, and what are you giving back to the tree, and how are you facilitating it to continue to hold that space for you? Like, those kinds of components, we don't talk about that when we talk about grounding or embodiment for that matter, but I do approach them differently. Grounding is sort of step one. I don't know. I guess it could be different for different people. I would not project that it's the same for everybody, because I know my own experience of disability changes that day to day. But being embodied for me is owning my presence, but grounding is being in my place, like being in, participating in my ecosystem, I guess is the way I would put it, and seeing where we are same.
Mm. Yeah, you noted that grounding is the hardest part of the work.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah. Well, I can understand, because, you know, like you said, you know, like if you have a relationship with a tree and, you know, or starting to develop it and you like to go and touch the tree, I don't think most people think, well, what does the tree ask in return?
There, and I think that's fundamental to our perspective around why do we think nature is always at our disposal?
Right.
There's something to ask in that. And I'm going to flip that and say nature almost always says yes.
Yeah.
There is a truth that nature, when you ask for help, pretty much always agrees, but it gets depleted. It gets depleted if there's not reciprocity in that relationship. And we've done that as an entire culture for way too long, and we're living the outcome of that. But, you know, what does a tree ask for in return? It might ask for something pretty that makes noise in its branches. It might ask for just acknowledgement, just thank you, just gratitude. Only your tree can tell you that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, we've been discussing elders, and the focus has been on human elders, but there would be non-human elders as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And how do we open relationship with them? Like, how can we prepare ourselves to be ready for that? Because we already struggle with the animism part of it. We struggle with who are our fit elders? Who do we really look up to? And if we don't, how might we carry our feelings around not having them into looking for ones that are other than human? Might we have biases there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was thinking, you know, the tree that we have that relationship with, the tree can be the elder.
Some of my best teachers, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always think of when I was engaged in my weekly hiking practice in my canyon, one of the reasons I started going to that canyon, I had tried a different spot, but it was just riddled with rattlesnakes. And I don't like snakes. And a student, I was mentioning this in class, and students, oh, we'll try this trail. There's hardly any rattlesnakes there. Well, there were rattlesnakes, not as many. And I found it really interesting over time how my relationship with rattlesnake changed. And I was able to get to the point of learning lessons from rattlesnake. And just by observing and being respectful and mindful, that rattlesnake became like an elder to me.
I love that. I have a similar experience with snakes.
Yeah.
And proximity to them with climate change. We have them almost year round now. Do they hibernate? Is that the word? They don't do that anymore here where I live. And so there are a lot more of them than there used to be in our immediate space. And I've had to have similar compassion.
Yeah.
That we occupy the same space.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and not just compassion, but respect.
Yes.
You know? Yeah, I
Yes.
think snake commands respect. Yeah, in so many ways. So I guess, one of the questions we've kind of circled around this a little bit, but for anyone who's listening and likes some of these ideas, because I don't know that animism is something that I would caution against accepting it as just another belief system. It seems to me that it needs to be something that's experienced.
Right.
And, we've talked about, go and touch a tree, try to develop these relationships. How would you, what other ways, and I know there's a lot in the book, but what other ways might someone begin to mend the broken path?
Well, you're right in that there's a lot of introspection in the book that is geared toward helping you answer that question, because I don't know that there is one particular gotcha for
Right,
everybody, but
right.
there will be one or
Yeah.
five. And I have like I still rub up against things that I'm like, that is in conflict with how I want to animism.
Yeah.
So that's part of it also, is realizing the places where you're like, okay, I think this, but I'm actually living in direct conflict with that. One of the things that there are a couple of things that I suggest to people early on in the teachings that I do. One of them is stuff that you are already doing that you can't help but do, like cook your food. Like, bring your awareness to how you prepare your food, not just the where it came from and what it might have gone through to get to you, but how you're handling it now, and how do you show reverence to it now? How do you introduce it to your pan and your table and your family? Like, just be there for that whole process. Make it sacred space, not just cooking and chopping and seasoning. Make that sacred space, and don't judge yourself in it or the food. Like,
Right.
just observe that process for yourself. And another one is going, if you can go outside, if you're able to go outside and pick a spot, start in one direction, and just acknowledge everything that you witness in that direction, everything that you sense on every level, five sense and beyond, every level, and thank that direction, and then turn to the next direction and do the same thing, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever you can, and do that in a complete cycle. And for me, I've done it probably hundreds of times by this point. I'm a different person when I get to the first direction.
Yeah.
Like, by the time I get all the way through it, and I've met beings by the time I get all the way through. I've lived here however long, and I still encounter new relationships and renew and death walk some relationships that I anticipate to be there that are no longer there. I mean, these are things that we can do in our day to day that don't have to necessarily be this high ritual experience.
Right. What do you mean by death walk?
Yep. So if there's the need for a word, death walk, that implies that something about death needs our facilitation. There's something about it that has human involvement as a requirement. My work largely focuses around death and dying. And the implication is how we live is how we die. So if we have not had the opportunity to reconcile traumas, if we carry things that maybe aren't even our traumas, but they're intergenerational, and we don't have the opportunity to reconcile them at death, or maybe we do, but we die traumatically. Whatever keeps us from moving on in a capacity that is complete, we don't leave our stuff here for other people to deal with, that means we have died well, in my vernacular. If that does not happen, it means we have not died well. We have left tension that shows up in living human anxiety. It shows up in our loved ones, it shows up in our systems. And that means that someone such as myself, needs to give death rites to that, needs to death walk it in such a way that it's not still sticking in human affairs anymore. And it's moved on to the point that it has the clean slate to make choices about how it moves further.
Okay. All right. I'm trying to remember something from the book, and I don't know that I can do this, but I seem to recall, and please correct me if I'm wrong, something about those who pass over who are still traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, how can we help them heal? Because it seems like they're still, that seems like it, that would be a necessary part of the healing of humanity.
Yeah.
and the world.
Yeah. And why aren't we doing that death work? Like yeah. that's the question that kind of travels along with that one. If we have beings who have died, but they did not get their stuff processed, you know, what do we do and why did that happen? Lots of people doing that work. That's yeah. the work that I do, Christina Pratt, Langston Kahn focus on that kind of work. Our death rites haven't been sufficient since we were animistic. Mm. Our ancestors would have had rites in place, not just to give this being a good death, to bless and release the traumas of their life, but to make sure that they have a good death that goes on in a way that they become a good ancestor, someone who is fit to guide and has wisdom they're willing to share. When that doesn't happen, it means they haven't had good death rites. And so like, well, but we had a funeral. What do you mean we didn't give good death rites? The way that the version of organized religion that tends to be dominant here does death rites, that isn't part of it. That isn't part of what they do. And so we do have thousands of years of dead who are unquiet, who contribute to this sort of energetic chatter in a non-helpful way, in some cases in an extremely harmful way. And so the job becomes not just helping people die now who are seeking to die well, but to be able to work with dead who have moved on and did not get that opportunity. And there are some specific techniques, many, I would say, across cultures that were cultivated and handed down, not just because that's a good thing to do, but because our ancestors knew that if that got disrupted for us at an animistic level, this is what happens. Mm. This is what, it wasn't just like, it's this good thing that we're going to do for our friend. It was a preventive measure to keep amassed, unwalked dead from happening.
So if someone passes over and they still have all this trauma, you know, it seems as if they may not have, we may not consider them like an elder because there may not be that wisdom. And the reason that I'm asking this is because the question then is, would, and I don't know if this is a good way of framing it, but this is what's coming to me. Would they be considered an ancestor? Do we automatically, you know, if someone simply came before us, is that an ancestor? Or does an ancestor imply that there has been healing and there is wisdom available?
There are different perspectives on that. And in different indigenous communities that I listen to, who have intact traditions that keep this question somewhat contained and from happening, they would have a different perspective. What I witness is in this trajectory of European diaspora into American culture is an enormous amount of unquiet dead. Mm. And it's challenging. It's challenging in many ways. Are they an ancestor because they went before us? Yes. But there's this sort of gradient of, are they causing harm or are they helping? And there's a lot in between that. There's a lot going on in between that. The ones that are causing harm are more like possessions, as in being possessed by them, still whispering. I would my example around that is the places where you are struggling with systems today, the systems hold you back today, you most likely had an ancestor who signed off on that being fine years ago, decades, generations ago. And so that's sort of a direct connection that people can make when they can say, wait a minute, the medical system does not see me. I am not being supported by the medical system. How did my ancestors play into that? Like what was happening when decisions about how the medical system of this country were being shaped? I have a direct relationship to that personally, like both in my own disability and in my own ancestors who created a path that they didn't realize one of their own was going to need down the line. So for me, that's one in or out into ancestor work that I do is working with ancestors who don't understand that harms they are still kind of carrying out are impacting me, who is the person with feet on the ground that can actually carry out what my lived traditions need me to at this time. There's contradiction there that I feel I'm responsible for addressing. And I've met people who don't feel that, people who are teachers of spiritual traditions who are like, no, that's not my responsibility. I only work with the well ancestors. Well, what about the gap?
This came up in another conversation I had, but it's this question of us healing the ancestors or contributing to the healing of the ancestors. And I think that's vital.
I think it is too. And again, I'm not saying that's true for everybody, but for the positionality that I have, I know in my lineages what things are not working. They're not working. And for me, that is an obligation to make sure that for my children and the children, that does not carry on. If I see it, I have an obligation to do something about that.
And the ancestors are not just our human ancestors.
That's correct. That is
And
correct.
so we can have ancestors of land and place and our non-human, animal kin. These can all be ancestors to us.
And I find when people are beginning ancestral work, those are the ones that are more fit to connect with first. Like a lot of people just want to say, well, I want to connect with my ancestors. And I'm like, that's maybe opening the door a little too much at the beginning. Let's connect with the ones who do have our best interest in mind. And they do and are in a position in whatever their own experience is to be able to share that in a way that's beneficial. Let's go to them first.
And how would you recommend people begin developing a relationship with their ancestors?
I feel like a lot of people have someone that they feel good about. A lot of people do, and that is an in route. A lot of people don't. They vehemently are like, nobody I know. And that puts an immediate barrier to, well, what about before them? What about way before them? What about asking for one of those ancestors who remembers animism and how to support the community? Why don't we reach for them first? And I know for other people, they would say, why don't we ask for like an ambassador to the ancestors to come, or like an usher that helps us create that relationship into the ancestors? There are some I think smart little wordings that help us not nail it down too finely and leave it open enough to say, I need someone who is absolutely exalted in what they do, in their ancestor. That's who I need to talk to first. And it may not be human.
I've set up an altar for the ancestors and try to make daily offerings. And that's how I began trying to develop a relationship, just by through acknowledgement.
Absolutely. I think having that physical manifestation where you're focusing your energy on a regular basis is really important.
Okay. Well, Kelly, I know that we are pretty much out of time. I have enjoyed this conversation, but let me ask you, what do you have coming up next? What are you working on?
I think I always have lots of things coming up. The thing that is most immediate is an ongoing community of called Runes for Change, which is made up of people who are interested in approaching the Elder Futhark runes from an animistic perspective and rooting them into their place. And it's awesome because we have all these people from all over the world who are doing that in their place. It's not just this, one area is represented. And there's so much to learn. Like, even for me, there's so much to learn from having that community aspect of working with the runes. So, Runes for Change is something that's happening ongoing. And at the first of the year, I'll be starting another cohort in the Spirited Path, which is the long-term intensive that I teach, where some people just kind of want to learn to cultivate an animistic perspective, and that is plenty and enough. And some people want to deepen that with soul skills that help them do death work or help them do soul retrievals, that kind of thing. So that will start over again in January.
Okay. And I know that you've got your website behind you there, soulintentarts.com. Is that where people can go to find out about the Runes for Change and the cohort? Okay, perfect.
Absolutely, yes.
Perfect. Well, I will put a link for that in the show notes in the
Thank
video
you.
description, as well as links for your latest book, From Elder to Ancestor. There's a lot of valuable information and wisdom in the book, so I encourage people to pick it up and give it a good read. So, Kelly, again, thank you so much for your time this morning. I very much appreciated the conversation.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. It was my pleasure. And that's a wrap on episode 157 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, most of you know what's coming up next, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family, and on social media too, please. Subscribe or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics, and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.